Hello, this is Mike Swanson. I'm the author of the book, The War State, The Cold War Origins of the Military-Industrial Complex and the Power Elite. In a few moments, another episode of The Great Parallax Views will begin. But before it starts, let me tell you about my book. It's available at Amazon.com, The War State. It's about how the United States became a global superpower after World War II and has brought us to this situation. Grab the book at Amazon.com after the show.
I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views.
And I mean three things by global police state. The first thing I mean is that with these incredible inequalities and deprivation that we've touched on, the ruling groups need to and are developing and extending worldwide transnational systems of social control, repression, militarization, and warfare to contain the actual and the potential rebellion of the mass of humanity, what I call surplus humanity and the global working class. So that's the first thing I mean by global police state, these new sophisticated worldwide systems of control and repression. The second thing I mean by it, because you're familiar with the book, you know I mean three things. The second, and this is something very new, no one else is linking it to the structural crisis of capitalism, of global stagnation. And these systems, this global police state, is immensely profitable. And it allows transnational corporations, the transnational corporate elite, to have an outlet for investment to continue making profits in the face of stagnation. So that's the second thing I mean. But to conclude, the third thing I mean by global police state is that we are seeing the spread of political systems that can be characterized as 21st century fascist.
Hey there, Parallax Views listeners. On this edition of the program, we live in a moment of crisis where social uprisings and state repression have become more and more common. How can we better understand this zeitgeist of the tumultuous and unpredictable? Well, our guest, sociologist William I. Robinson, provides an analysis and theoretical understanding that may be useful in these uncertain times with his new book, The Global Police State. Don't get it mixed up, though. This is not a work akin to the tinfoil hat rantings of Alex Jones or maybe Glenn Beck. Instead, it is a serious academic work detailing the relationship between crises created by capitalism and the ways in which the transnational capitalist class, or more specifically, certain elements of it, are seeking to deal with the social upheavals that are occurring due to racial injustices and looming threats such as ecological catastrophe. As savage economic inequalities rapidly increase at an alarming rate, Robinson argues we are facing the threat of a new 21st century fascism. He joins us on this edition of the show to detail what he calls the global police state. And now, on to the conversation with William I. Robinson. Welcome to Parallax Views, Professor William I. Robinson, author of the fascinating new book, The Global Police State. How are you doing today, William?
I'm good. Thank you so much for having me on.
So, William, I want to get into the title of the book, The Global Police State, because I know people have images of, you know, Alex Jones and InfoWars in their head. But I think you're talking about something very real, not this sort of Glenn Beck and Alex Jones type right-wing conspiracy stuff. But before we get into that, I guess we have to talk about how we got here and how we've reached this point of rising inequality, and an elite that is ultra wealthy and leaving everyone else behind. How did we get to this point?
Sure. Well, that's a really important question. It's a great jumping off point to start talking about global police state. But capitalism, and at this point, the entire world is now capitalist. There are no countries that are outside of this global capitalist system. Capitalism, by its own internal dynamics, generates tremendous amount of wealth, but polarizes that wealth. So this is not new that you have wealth concentrated on one end, the rich getting richer and the poor getting poorer and moving down. But in the, especially in the 20th century, mass struggles against this inequality and mass struggles for redistribution at the level of the nation state attenuated this tendency for capitalism to polarize wealth, make the rich richer and the poor poorer. All kinds of, you know, the, symbolically, it was the New Deal in the United States, but that New Deal is sort of a global compact, a global class compromise, we call it more technically, in which the tendency for capitalism to polarize this wealth and have the rich richer and the poor poorer was offset. There were mass struggles at the level of the nation state that forced that type of redistribution. But what happens towards the late 20th century, the leading capitalist groups and capitalist corporations at the level of the nation state, they go global. They break free of the constraints on their own profit making, their own accumulation at the level of the nation state. And so that unleashes, like we've never seen before, the tendency that capitalism naturally has to polarize wealth. And your listeners, I'm sure, familiar with this shocking data that in 2020, 1% of humanity controls over 50% of the world's wealth. And more importantly is the next figure, that 20% of humanity, and I have to say this is shrinking, it's moving down to 15 and 12 and 10% as this whole process deepens, but 20% of humanity in 2020 controls 95% of the world's wealth. That means that just 5% of the world's wealth has to be shared by 80% of the world's population. So this inequality is simply unprecedented. And specifically, you ask how we got there to such extreme levels. It really needs to be dated back to the late 20th century. And I want to add one more follow-up point there. Why is it that the leading capitalist groups and corporations launched globalization in the late 20th century? And it's because the working classes, the popular classes, the poor were on the rise and rebelling everywhere around the world. And this rebellion, these struggles from below were taking place at the level of the nation state, where mass struggles could put pressure on states to control capital, to redistribute wealth, to have new deals and so forth. And so the capitalist groups wanted to break free of that. And they launched this globalization, getting us to where we are in 2020.
Now, there's just a few things I wanted to untangle there, because I've mentioned to others that, you know, everyone is involved in this capitalist system. Now, it has gone global. And a lot of younger people, and I'm sure you've gotten this from a student or two, will say, ah, but what about China? Isn't China communist? How do you untangle those sort of things for a lay audience? Because I do think China is a participant in a global capitalist system, even if they, you know, claim to be a communist state.
Sure. Yeah, that's a great question. And it's very important. And of course, China is part of this larger story of global police state that I want to talk about in just a moment. But China, in the 1978, began the process of, a process of change in China. And in the late 20th century, accelerating to date, China has integrated ever deeper into global capitalism. China is now a capitalist society. But it's a different type of capitalism than the United States or than Western Europe, in the sense that there is a major portion of that capitalist system is what we call state capitalism, meaning that there are state firms and the state plays a major role in regulating the process of capital accumulation, the process of the capitalist economy. But it's still capitalist. And in China, by the way, China has more billionaires than the United States at this point. But in China, inequality has skyrocketed. China is now one of the most unequal countries in the world. It's rivaling the United States. And, you know, in Brazil and India, other countries that are historically have extreme levels of inequality. The Chinese Communist Party likes to say that what they're doing is developing socialism with Chinese characteristics. But I would say they are developing capitalism with Chinese characteristics. And one other point there, you know, if you bring up China, is that the leading Chinese corporations, whether they're private, and the private corporations are multi-billion dollar global worldwide corporations, or whether they're the state corporations, such as the Chinese oil company, the Chinese banks, they are cross-invested with Western-based and you know, with transnational corporations from all over the world. So the Chinese capitalist class is part of what I refer to as the transnational capitalist class. I would love to expand the focus here to bring in, you know, how global police state is related to this.
Yeah, if we could, what do we mean by the global police state?
Yeah. So the starting point to talk about global police state, and absolutely, I'm not talking about this conspiratorial Glenn Beck or whatever conception of a police state. The starting point has to be the crisis of global capitalism. The system is facing a severe crisis. Some people say the worst in 100 years. I say for certain reasons, it's the worst crisis in the 500 plus year history of this system. And there's multiple dimensions. There's, of course, the ecological dimension, which makes this an existential crisis. But if we want to link the crisis to global police state, we want to focus on two particular dimensions. One is the structural dimension. The technical term is overaccumulation, but essentially the structural dimension of the crisis is that the global economy has been facing chronic stagnation for quite a while. And why? Because of this inequality. When 80% of humanity cannot consume, you have the global economy pouring out all of this wealth, and it cannot be absorbed by the global market, because 80% of humanity is pushed out more and more out of consumption. So you have the structural dimension of the crisis. I'm going to show how that's linked to global police state in a moment. But the second dimension of this crisis of global capitalism is its political dimension. This is a crisis of state legitimacy and of capitalist hegemony. The pandemic did not cause this crisis of global capitalism, although it did intensify it many times over, bringing us to this moment of inflection and very dangerous moment that I think we're at this point. And the capitalist states around the world, this includes the Chinese state and the U.S. state, we were just talking about those two countries, have been simply unable to cope with the crisis and with the pandemic, and they have been exposed as instruments of wealth and corruption. And this pushes states around the world to intensify global police state. So you ask me then what I mean by global police state. Well, for me, this is a concept which is really essential to understanding where we're at in 2020. And I mean three things by global police state. The first thing I mean is that with these incredible inequalities and deprivation that we've touched on, the ruling groups need to and are developing and extending worldwide transnational systems of social control, repression, militarization, and warfare to contain the actual and the potential rebellion of the mass of humanity, what I call surplus humanity and the global working class. So that's the first thing I mean by global police state, these new sophisticated worldwide systems of control and repression. But the second thing I mean by it, because you're familiar with the book, you know I mean three things. The second, and this is something very new, no one else is linking it to the structural crisis of capitalism, of global stagnation. And these systems, this global police state, is immensely profitable, and it allows transnational corporations, the transnational corporate elite, to have an outlet for investment to continue making profits in the face of stagnation. So that's the second thing I mean. And I have very dramatic data that, if you've seen the book, you know is in there, and we can discuss that. But to conclude, the third thing I mean by global police state is that we are seeing the spread of political systems that can be characterized as 21st century fascist. So you have the political dimensions of the system coming together with the economic dimensions around global police state.
Now, really quickly, if I could here, since you mentioned globalization, and I want to get back to the global police state aspect, but what do we mean when we say globalization? Because for me, I'm actually okay with the idea of internationalism and things like international cooperation in face of the climate crisis, but I don't think that's what globalization is giving us. I don't think the World Economic Forum is including, non-elites in the discussion of how to deal with these crises we're facing.
Sure. Well, this concept of globalization has been a point of raging debate within academia, and that debate still continues. But it's also been a point of debate and discussion in the public discourse. And, you know, journalists and politicians started using that term together with academics in the late 1980s, really, the early 1990s. So there's no consensus on what we mean by globalization. But what I mean by it, and I've been writing about it, trying to come up with a theory of global capitalism of globalization for some 25 years now. What I mean by that is that we have a new globally integrated production, financial, and service system. Every single country in the world has been integrated into this new global system of production, finance, and services. And that's so crystal clear with the pandemic. Supply chains are all over the world. They cross through numerous countries. And because of the pandemic, when an individual country shuts down, the supply chain shuts down across multiple countries. So, you know, that's an example of this new globally integrated production, financial, and service system. So national borders recede. But also, I mean by globalization that the ruling groups that typically we associate with the national, like the capitalist class in the United States or the elite in the United States, those ruling groups, the leading edge of these different ruling groups in every country, have transnationalized. The corporations, of course, invested with one another. So they're in each other's countries. They own each other's what were traditionally national corporations and so forth. And so you're bringing up the issue of international cooperation. That's absolutely essential. We're not going to resolve the problems of ecological collapse, of warfare, of future pandemics, anything we're not going to resolve without cooperation across borders with the entire world community. But I think that's critically important if we, you know, issuing a political judgment. But that's not theoretically or analytically what I would mean by globalization. Just to summarize, in my own theory of global capitalism or globalization, I consider that we've entered a new, qualitatively new phase in the evolution of world capitalism. The system's been around for 530 years now, and it's entered a new stage in the late 20th century, intensifying now.
In regards to the global police state, and I want to get into why those things are intensifying, but first, with regards to global police state, we're seeing the sort of repression you're talking about hitting a fever pitch now with Black Lives Matter. One of the most interesting aspects of your book is that you talk about green zones and what's the other type of zone you talk
gray
about?
Gray zones.
Maybe you could lay out what are the green zones and the gray zones, because this seems to explain a great deal now.
Absolutely. Well, first, where I come up with those terms is that the U.S., as we know, invaded and occupied Iraq in 2003. And what the U.S. invasion force did is go into the center of Baghdad and set up an impenetrable barrier right in the core, in the center of Baghdad. And that was called, they called that, the U.S. occupiers called that the Green Zone. And inside the Green Zone were the U.S. occupiers themselves, the military high command, the political, you know, representatives of the U.S. occupation force. That's where they constructed this new U.S. embassy, the biggest in the world with several thousand employees. But also that is where they housed the new Iraqi elite that had been cultivated by the invasion, the economic and political elite, and they're all protected and living comfortably inside this green zone. And outside those that impenetrable barrier was a raging warfare, a mass of destruction and misery and bombs and every nightmare you can possibly imagine, along with incredible impoverishment and deprivation. And so that's a situation of a hot war, but that's what I mean by the gray zone. That 80% of humanity that lives outside of these very comfortable green zones, which are bubbles protected by global police state, protected by these new sophisticated systems of control and surveillance and repression. So what we see worldwide is a restructuring of space, new spatial relations. I call it the new global social apartheid, in which the big megacities of the world, including, I'm in Los Angeles, we see this crystal clear in New York and all of the big megacities of the world, we see a spatial reorganization. And the 20% that can live comfortably is behind gated communities, behind well-guarded and well-policed communities, and there's all kinds of restructuring of space and social life. And outside that is increasingly the gray zone, where global police state and systems of repression and surveillance and control beat back on the populations in these megacities. So we're seeing the green zoning and gray zoning worldwide. But let me give you, because again, you've seen the book, so there's shocking data in there. I'm speaking analytically, but behind it is all of this data. Here's one example. So just here in California, where I am, there are no less than 592 laws restricting standing, sitting, resting, sleeping, panhandling, food sharing for homeless people in public spaces. So the idea is this total control of public space. Again, 592 laws. There are 771 laws here in California restricting non-public spaces. So you have this extreme tight control of space, of what can be done for the people in the gray zone.
I was going to say, it reminds me of hostile architecture. Now we have to make park benches that, you know, the homeless can't sleep on. You know, this seems to all tie together.
Exactly. Exactly. The idea of global police state, it's not just the police like in Portland, you know, cracking down their batons or throwing tear gas and rubber bullets at protesters. That's part of the story. But this is much more complex analysis that how social life, how the economy, how political a life, how space itself is all being restructured and reorganized so as to defend a system in which at most 20% can survive and get by. And, you know, it's worth reminding the listeners and the viewers here that some of these new modalities of policing and repression, and by the way, they're made possible by the new digital technologies. And not only are they immensely profitable, that's the economic dimension of global police state we haven't touched on, but you have systems of mass incarceration, you have immigrant detention and deportation regimes, we have refugee control systems, we have border and containment walls. The U.S.-Mexico borders wall is just one of all over the world. That's part of gray zoning and green zoning. We have new systems of mass surveillance and tracking, and this is heightening now with the pandemic. We have this new militarized urban policing. We know in the United States that the police now have military level, you know, hardware, but this is worldwide. We have the spread of paramilitary and private armies and security forces that work alongside public forces. We have the blurring of the military of military and civilian, what the boundaries between the military and civilian, and so forth and so on. I mean, it could go on endlessly. And I have, you know, a lot of this shocking data.
What's the most shocking piece of data for you? What stands out the most that sort of should be jarring to my listeners?
Well, let's see. I've become a little numb to it after researching this in 6 years, but here's some data on, by the way, I call it militarized accumulation or accumulation by repression, meaning that, and let me tell an anecdote in just a moment to give your listeners and your viewers a perfect example. But what I mean by militarized accumulation and accumulation by repression is that increasingly capitalist groups conduct develop and deploy systems of repression, social control and warfare just to make profit for no other reason. So September 11 of 2001 was a big turning point here. It led to the sweeping militarization of the global economy and society. We're now in a global war economy, but here's some of that shocking data that you're asking for. The Pentagon budget increased from 1998 to 2015 by 98% in real terms. Worldwide military spending increased by 50% during this period. That does not include state secret budgets, police budgets, intelligence service budgets, homeland security budgets, which are also number into the hundreds of billions, possibly beyond into the trillions of dollars. I calculate in the book that if you combine all of the state spending, and this is only state spending, you're talking about between 4% and 6% of the entire global economy now dependent on state military and spending on the military and on systems of repression. But then we have private corporate spending and the increased privatization of warfare and repression. So there are 20 million private police in the world. Those are people that work for corporations and they're doing policing because that's how they get paid. And the corporations are deploying them as police, 20 million around the world, just to make profit. And in half of the countries of the world, there are more private police than public police. There are 15 million people that now work in what we call private military firms. And these are mercenary firms, but now there's 15 million people working for them worldwide, possibly more. And they are hired by transnational corporations to defend mining operations or to put down revolts that are targeting corporations. The Mexican government at one point hired one corporation from South Africa to fight the Zapatistas. That's the indigenous rebellion in southern Mexico. After the Soviet Union collapsed, no less than 10,000 private military firms were established in what is now Russia. G4S is the world's largest private security firm. They employ 660,000 people. That's the third largest corporation after Foxconn and Walmart. The European Union started in the early 2000s, but especially after the Arab Spring revolt of 2011, when refugees, and then the wars in Syria and so forth, when refugees were moving into Europe, they established this European Union border security program. And it wasn't about security of because these poor fleeing refugees were not representing a threat. It was about making profit. And so the budget for European border security increased by an incredible 3,688% between 2005 and 2016. And this spending was private corporations. We're not talking about government spending. Now we're talking about governments coming up with those resources to hand over to private corporations. There's now a global riot control systems market. And I have a quote that I seem to have misplaced here, but Lloyd's of London, which is this big global financial and insurance conglomerate, Lloyd's of London had this wonderful quote, sorry, I don't have it in front of my papers right now, in which they're saying that protests all around the world, including social movements, those protesting an occupying force, those protesting for more social justice. They, you know, they went through this list of protests and resistance activities by poor people, by working people, by social movements, and said, this is creating a new global riot control system market, which is going to go into the hundreds of billions of dollars over the next few years. So that is, in other words, that we have this Black Lives Matter anti-racist uprising in the United States. Now, for the political system in the United States, that's a crisis. They're challenging the legitimacy of the system and trying to overturn racism. But for corporate capital, that's a bonanza. Corporate capital involved in this global riot control system market love civic conflict and, you know, and policing and so forth and so on. So I can go on and on and on. I don't know if you would like to give me one single example, you know, of how this plays out.
Go on.
Okay, so if some of your listeners may remember that in 2009 and 2010, Arizona passed this draconian anti-immigrant legislation. Then copycat legislation spread all over the United States. Now immigrants are being locked up in cages, children taken away from the parents. We all know that. But really a key turning point was this piece of legislation in Arizona in 2010. It was passed, called SB 1070, SB for state bills, 1070. But where did it come from? Well, there's a story here. The biggest for-profit immigrant detention company is Corrections Corporation of America. They now changed their name to CoreCivic because it sounds nicer. Corrections Corporation of America is part of this organization called ALEC. ALEC stands for American Legislative Exchange Commission. And ALEC brings together the CEOs of the leading global corporations operating in the United States with state-level legislatures. And they meet, and the corporations bring draft bills, draft legislation that they want the state representatives to go back and pass in the individual 50 states. And so three strikes you're out law, which is this mass incarceration law, was brought there. All of the leading corporations are there. So this particular year, they had their meeting in Colorado, in Denver. And Corrections Corporation of America, which again runs the private immigrant detention centers, and they make hundreds of dollars every night that every immigrant is locked up. So if you are a shareholder in Corrections Corporation of America, you want a war against immigrants, but not because you are racist necessarily, you don't like Latinos, Mexicans, or Central Americans coming, simply because every immigrant locked up every night gives you hundreds of dollars in profits. So ALEC drafts a bill. This bill in Arizona, the anti-immigrant bill, SB 1070, it drafts that legislation, brings it to the meeting in Denver, says to the governor of Arizona, Jan Brewer at the time, and her assistant, the two of them, Jan Brewer and I forgot the assistant's name, Russell Pierce, says to the two of them, please take this legislation, which is draconian anti-immigrant piece of law, and pass it in Arizona. Now, why would Jan Brewer and Russell Pierce do that? Well, because they are also shareholders in Corrections Corporation of America. You have the link between economic and political elites. And so the law is passed in Arizona. From there, copycat laws are spread all over the United States and launches this deadly new phase of the anti-immigrant, you know, the war against immigrants that we're living in now. Now, the final point to remember here is that Corrections Corporation of America is traded on Wall Street and in other stock exchanges. An investor in China, an investor in India, you or me, an investor in South Africa can buy shares in Correction Corporation of America. And when they do that, they have an objective interest in a war on immigrants because it simply means profit. So here you see how the political demand, and so if that's how you're making your money, then you want to have someone like Trump and your public officials whip up anti-immigrant hysteria. You want to see racism, but not because you even dislike immigrants, but simply because this is the new way that the global economy offers profit-making opportunities from global police state in the face of stagnation. That one example I just gave you can be multiplied hundreds of times over.
So I want to come back to the anti-immigration thing for a minute, but first, I want to get into the technological aspect of global police state. There is, as I said, sort of an Alex Jones type view that becomes, oh, they have a total control grid and there's no fighting back against it, and this real doom and gloom type stuff. But I also see how, you know, it seems like some of these technologies, these surveillance technologies, can be disabled. You know, there was the Hong Kong protesters using the lasers, and there's these kids that are into rap and into this band, the Insane Clown Posse, who they found that wearing the face paint they wear actually screws up the facial recognition. Mm-hmm. Should we be worried about the extent of the technology's capability for surveillance? Is that overplayed? Is there another aspect we should be worried about in regards to this? What's your take?
I don't think it's overplayed at all. Again, you don't want to get into this conspiratorial panic, right? That's not it. But we have to analyze.
It's not perfect, though. The surveillance tech is what I'm.
Oh, not in the least bit. No. There's always resistance. There are always holes in the system. The system is in crisis. That's what also we want to remember. If we're talking about global police state being developed with the dual purpose, first of making tremendous profits, such as the war on immigrants is profitable, the war in Syria is profitable, all of this, right? The military budgets are profitable for the military industrial security Silicon Valley complex. The global police state is being developed in order to contain the rebellion from below worldwide, then we have to say that global police state is a reaction to the crisis. It's a reaction. The global police state isn't starting by taking the initiative. On the contrary, it's an effort to try and shore up the system, which is actually much more fragile than it appears in crisis. That's what the crisis of legitimacy and hegemony that I was speaking about previously. And there are all kinds of holes. And in any way, this is an objective contradiction. You cannot have a global society where 80% of humanity is slipping down towards a situation where they can't even survive. And within that 20%, there is a restructuring of the labor force. The 20% is typically professionals, knowledge workers, what we call cognitive workers, and so forth. And even that 20% is increasingly being de-skilled and making redundant as a result of these technologies. The problem with seeing this as conspiratorial is to say that someone in Google developed a technology because they want to dominate the world. Okay, that's conspiratorial, right? And that it's all powerful and in every single thing we do and say. But it's not conspiratorial to see how these new technologies were developed over the last 30, 40 years, and are now, we're calling it the fourth industrial revolution, especially driven by AI, by artificial intelligence, by robotization, by machine learning and so forth. I'm sure you're all familiar with these new technologies. They're developed because they're very profitable for a corporation to develop them, or because they enhance productivity in a factory, or for any numerous reasons. They're developed also by the military because they enhance weapon systems. But once they come into being, they allow the ruling groups at a time of crisis to attempt to undertake much tighter control, including surveillance. These iPhones, these smartphones that we all walk around with now, and we know this is documented, it's not conspiratorial, is a way that of monitoring our every single movement. Yes.
I wanted to add something here. I mean, the technology that was rolled out here in Pittsburgh when we had the G8, you know, maybe a decade ago, was really frightening. I mean, they were using sound cannons. And, people are really hurt by these things. And this is the point we're at now. We have a militarized police with technology like sound cannons. And now, as you were going to say, the iPhones, the tracking technology.
Yes. And with the pandemic, all of this is accelerating. I have been the book came out this summer as the fruit of 6 years of research. And towards the end of that research, I really started focusing on, and this will be my next book, come out another few years, on how global capitalism is being restructured once again through these new digital technologies. So there's this new wave of digitalization. It's just really coming online now. It's also driven by what we call big data, the amassing and the processing of enormous, unbelievable amounts of data. So capitalism is going through a new round of profound restructuring. And part of that means that there's incredibly enhanced productivity. Less and less people are required as workers. And when they're not required as workers, when they're replaced by robots, replaced by technology, they join the ranks of that 80%. And so that aggravates the contradictions in this system. But I think I lost the train of thought. You were asking more specifically, right? The control dimension. Right.
I was asking about the control dimension and the actual specific technologies being used, like concrete examples.
Sure. So I can't put an image up here. And in any case, the listeners wouldn't see the image. But in the agricultural sector, when you have these giant animal husbandry, agribusiness farms, you have all of these cows and they're put out in a passage, in a pasture. So they're already have on them chips. The cows are the steer, they're given chips. And then from a computer terminal in some place, it can be anywhere in the world, actually, computer terminal, but let's say on this big farm, right? The chips tell you exactly where your cow is moving. And when the cow leaves the area where the cows or these animals are supposed to be grazing, an alarm goes off. And of course, you can do other things. You can give it a little shock, or many different things, but you're completely monitoring the movement of every single cow and controlling where it can go and where it can't go. Okay, so iPhones now, the smartphones now play the same role in the sense that, well, conspiratorially speaking, but it's not conspiracy, police agencies and the military can control that, but also the corporations are able to identify our every movement through our smartphones. And that's not conspiratorial, that's been demonstrated. So here's the link with global police state, is that police need to know if you're going to crack down on anti-racist protests in the United States, if you're going to escalate the war against immigrants, if you're going to intervene in Yemen, whatever it is. The ability to monitor each human being's physical movements and know where they're located at any one time and reach them through these smartphones and these other technologies is very powerful, and it's very dangerous. And it heightens the capacity of global police state to conduct control and repression. The reason this is not, one reason this is not simply a conspiratorial argument is, again, we're linking it to this objective structural issue of capitalism's structural crisis, right? And how forms of accumulating capital and corporate technologies or so forth are also part of how capitalism functions as an economic system.
Now, I want to go back to the anti-immigration thing, because what you said, I think, is very important, that there are people that profit off of this anti-immigration sentiment. You mentioned Core Civics. Palantir has been involved with police groups in this country. So we have all these connections. And yet at the same time, we have the sort of right-wing noise machine and people like Tucker Carlson saying, oh, the Silicon Valley types and the Silicon Valley digital capitalists and the big tech capitalists, they're going after us right-wingers. They like big immigration, so they don't have to pay people anything. When really there's a whole segment of the capitalist class that is okay with anti-immigration sentiment.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think it's a big mistake to see that Trump came along, and that's where anti-immigrant hysteria starts to be whipped up, and that's where the war against immigrants starts to take place. That's totally false. More people were caught, caged, and deported under Obama. This is not particularly Republican or Democrat. This war against immigrants has been going on for quite some time. A really key turning point was 2006, when there were immigrant uprisings against repressive legislation, mega marches. If you're old enough to remember that, there was 14 years ago. But then the other turning point came again in 2009, when I mentioned that Corrections Corporation of America introduced this legislation, which was then passed in numerous other states, copycat laws in other states, simply to make profit. So this is not the war against immigrants is not specifically a far right thing. But there is the dimension of fascism. And let me try and link that with the war against immigrants, because I was mentioning there's three things I mean by global police state. One is that it's enormously profitable, so it helps the global economy in the face of stagnation. Secondly, it controls rebellion from below. But third, there's this rise of these systems of 21st century fascism. And fascism is a particular response to capitalist crisis, an extreme far-right coercive response, which undermines the ability for legally and democratically for sectors of the population to exercise their influence. And we're closer to fascism in the United States right now than we've ever been before. But we want to see that fascism, whether in its 20th century variant in Nazi Germany or in Italy or in Spain, and now it's 21st century variant, because we have it arising in the United States, in Eastern and Western Europe, in India, in Turkey, in Israel, in a number of places. But we want to see that the other key thing about fascism is it takes place when the system's in crisis and masses of people are rejecting the system as not legitimate. So those people are experiencing, masses of people experience downward mobility, social economic destabilization, rising social anxiety. And they could challenge the system and say, well, the source of our destabilization or insecurity is the system itself. So the fascist project seeks to channel that mass social anxiety towards scapegoated communities and external enemies. And here the role of the war on immigrants needs to be seen in the United States as a key way that sectors of the working class in the United States, particularly white, particularly male, but not limited, just limited, have been experiencing extreme social anxiety and social and economic destabilization, downward mobility. And if they joined forces with Black and Latino and immigrants to challenge the system's in big trouble. So this base of Trump really is these white sectors of the working class whose consciousness of why they're experiencing anxiety and destabilization and insecurity is channeled towards a target, external target, and immigrants, among others. So this is a key function of fascism, to channel this mass social anxiety in times of capitalist crisis towards a way that's not going to threaten the system.
I was going to add to that. What's interesting is that you do have these areas of the country which have been derogatively called flyover country, or the sort of left behinds of the country. And you look at places like West Virginia or parts of Oklahoma that are now suffering from either crises environmentally created by coal mining or lead mining. These areas have been decimated. They've essentially been turned into what amounts to environmental sacrifice zones. And yet you have the right wing saying, oh, you know, Trump is for these little guys. Trump is for the people in Pennsylvania and West Virginia, when really they support the very same corporations that have allowed for those areas to become sacrifice zones.
This is a really great point. It's extremely important to look at this. Trump's economic program is in favor of what I call the transnational capitalist class. He himself is a member of the transnational capitalist class. What he has done is he's deepened the neoliberal program, the program of the rich getting richer and the poor get poorer, and put it on steroids. The regressive tax that was just passed, the completely deregulating corporations, giving giveaways of public lands. I mean, we can go on and on. Trump's whole social economic program is an attack against all poor and working people, including his own social base, which is why, again, this fascist dimension of channeling that the crisis of his own social base towards an external enemy. But absolutely, Trump represents the interests of Wall Street. He represents the interests of Silicon Valley, he represents the interests of the giant global corporations, and they love his economic program. They don't like other aspects of his program, and there's a lot of division and fissures within the ruling political and economic elite, but they have no problem with Trump's general program. The other thing that you were touching on, your point, is so important, that there are tens of millions of people in the United States that are white, rural areas, but also urban areas, that are experiencing downward mobility and immiseration. They have no objective stake in the system. They have these pandemics of suicide and pandemics of opiates, and they're disproportionately actually hitting these poor white people. And so it's more urgent than ever for those ruling over this system to assure that those tens of millions of people don't develop an alliance, a unity and struggle with all the rest of us. And so, you know, the other thing you're raising leads to a critique of some of what we've done on the left, which is to ignore these tens of millions rather than seeing that they are being destabilized and victimized by global capitalism and our potential allies. And so we've turned over that to Trump's social base and to this, you know, neo-fascist social base. And that's a mistake. And many of us have noted that.
I agree with you on that. I think the other point I was trying to get to is that Trump, Steve Bannon, all these figures, Tucker Carlson, who himself is an heir to a very rich family, these are people that are saying we are a populist movement. We are for the little man that's been left behind, when really they're being backed by elements of the transnational capitalist class. And to be sure, other elements don't like what Trump is doing, but there is an element of this class that is very supportive of Donald Trump, billionaires like Sheldon Adelson.
Well, not just, yes, Sheldon Adelson and of course the Koch brothers, but not just them. On the contrary, Trump has extremely broad support within the transnational corporate class, within the transnational capitalist class, and especially, again, for his economic program, but even for dimensions of his political program. These Tucker Carlson and, you know, the Fox, they're obviously, we know they don't represent poor and working people at all. They're the enemy of poor and working people, but they play the key ideological function. They play the ideological function of subterfuge, of creating this mass, if you want to use the term, we don't really use it in academia, but false consciousness. But absolutely. But the other thing I want to mention here is that the ruling political and economic elite is deeply divided. The crisis is intensifying those divisions. And that opens up space for us from below to take advantage of those divisions. But yes, there is behind Trump is a significant block of transnational corporate capital. But at the same time, the political instability represented by Trump and the divisions that Trumpism creates within the U.S. ruling bloc is repeated all over the world right now. The ruling groups don't know how to maintain control of this system. It's out of control. It's in deep economic and structural crisis. It's facing a deep political crisis. It's facing ecological disasters, so forth and so on. And so the ruling groups have all of these fissures and all of these divisions, and some of those are real. Now, I'm not talking about the division between a Fox News anchor and some from the Democratic Party, and talking about much deeper divisions. The ruling groups they're rudderless. They don't know how to respond to this crisis.
I guess the way I look at it, and I think people have a hard time looking at this because we see elites as necessarily monolithic. But for example, you know, I think there are elements of the transnational capitalist class that we can't really reach that are just, let's go full on fascism. And I would say there's another side, maybe represented by figures like Charles Schwab at the World Economic Forum, who I don't think they have our best interests at heart, but I think they were at least willing to maybe cut some type of deal, give us some type of reforms, rather than go the way of Trump. Would you agree or disagree with that sentiment, that there's a liberal element of the elites?
Absolutely, absolutely. And in the final chapter, there's four chapters in the book, The Global Police State, the final chapter looks at that. And I would suggest that we need to see three factions within the elite worldwide, and simplifying things here. First, you have the fascists. And I'm talking about political factions in this sense. What are they proposing for the system? And of course, that's Trumpism. That's what we've already discussed. There's a second wing of the ruling elites worldwide, and what I refer to them as the neoliberals, the neoliberal business as usual. That unfortunately is Biden and Harris. And that program is to go back to the neoliberalism that we've had, the capitalist globalization that we've had over the last 20 to 30 years. Now, they are not fascists. They're not calling for a suspension of democracy and so forth. That's the second one. The problem with these neoliberal business as usual people, if they get in power, they're going to follow the social and economic policies that to begin with have thrown us into this crisis and to begin with have generated a social base for fascist projects.
And intensified the economic inequality that has led to this.
Exactly. So you have Obama talking about, being progressive on some social and cultural issues, but his economic program is simply intensifying the downward mobility of the majority of us and throwing and turning over a social base to fascist projects, to Trump. You know, in large part, and I know this is a controversial argument, but I've been arguing it for years. It's Obama and his Weimar Republic for 8 years that generated the conditions that allowed Trump to come to power and allowed a fascist project to intensify its prospects. But then there's the third wing of the elite, and that's what you're referring to, the reformist elements among the elite. They are, some of them are clustered in the World Economic Forum, the Davos crowd, and in Switzerland. Some of them are on, more on the left wing of the Democratic Party. Of course, we have the, you know, we have Bernie Sanders or Jeremy Corbyn in the UK. But this reformist elite, and they have their intellectuals also. The books of the intellectuals of this reformist elite are standard texts on U.S. campuses. People like Jeffrey Sachs and Joseph Stiglitz represent the intellectual thinking of the reformist elite. And they are acknowledging that the system is in deep trouble and that they need to save capitalism from itself through a restoration of social programs, through a redistribution of wealth downward, through fundamental reforms and social safety nets, through, for instance, the United States minimum wages, a re-regulation of capital, progressive taxation, a tax on speculative capital. So there is this reform program out there. There's these three elites with the three different programs, and those reformist elites represent for us from below, who are trying to bring about fundamental social change and justice, they represent the possibility of alliances with them, of political coalitions with them, so long as they are not exercising leadership and hegemony over this global revolt. But yes, that's a very, very important factor, this three-way split in the elites and the possibility of a reformist program among the elites, offering something positive to masses of people in struggle.
The reason I brought that up, by the way, is, you know, people will say, well, that third faction of elites, really, they're only worried about preventing a global upheaval, which I think is true. It's not necessarily driven by right. altruism. But then again, I don't think FDR or Keynes were driven by altruism. I think they knew full well that they had to make some type of reforms to keep the immiseration from happening that would lead to revolts. And I think that that's the faction that we can apply the most pressure to.
Precisely. I mean, we are on the same page in that analysis. You know, George Soros, remember that we've had waves of crises. We're in this crisis now. I'm talking about specifically a recession or a depression. We're in this crisis now, sparked by the pandemic, but the underlying process, the underlying structures were not put in place by the pandemic. We had the 2008 Great Recession. And then we had the global financial crisis that started in 1997, 1998 in Asia, in East Asia, and then culminated with the dot-com bust of 2000, 2001. At that time, the 2000, 2001 bust, George Soros, who is a representative of this reformist elite, he's also a big global multi-billionaire capitalist, but he's representative of this political program, the reformist elite. He published a book. I forgot the exact name of the book suddenly, but the whole thrust of the book was saving capitalism from itself. And the underlying thesis of the book is George Soros saying we need to save capitalism from itself by undertaking significant reforms, real reforms, not just, you know, cosmetic reforms, but real significant restructuring and reform of the system. But he's doing so not because he's in the favor of the mass of, you know, poor working people, the global working class and surplus humanity, but because he's a billionaire. He's a part of the transnational capitalist class, a multi-billionaire, and he wants to save this system from threats from below. But as you pointed out so correctly, that the New Deal and came out of the Roosevelt government in the 1930s was a result of mass struggle from below, radical working class struggle on all fronts, and a strong socialist and communist movement, which found common ground by pressuring the Roosevelt wing of the political elite in the United States around this project of the New Deal. So in some ways, we're at a similar situation in that there is reformist elements among the global elite, and there's this mass revolt from below. But in other ways, it looks very, very different than the 1930s.
I wanted to add to that, because I think for me, the big difference is, I think in the 20th century, you had a very strong left-wing movement in the U.S., and across the world. We had something there. And, you know, people will say, oh, the left is like Democrats. I don't think so. I think the Democrats are actually, you know, right of center, especially in the U.S. We don't have a strong left-wing movement anymore that can push back against all of this. Would you agree with that? And how can we overcome this problem?
Well, I do agree with it. And what I see is this disjuncture, the disjuncture which is not favorable to us. So let me explain what, yes, you're absolutely right. The 1930s was a time of strong socialist and communist left and insurgent trade union movement and the Congress of Industrial Organizations. And that was worldwide. It was not just in the US. Here we're talking about the US. That was worldwide. Remember, the Nazis came to power to crush, in the first instance, the socialist and communist and trade union movement in Germany. That was their first job, crush the left. So right now we have this terrible disjuncture between hundreds of millions of people around the world, and in the United States, tens of millions or more, that are hungry for change, that are taking to the streets. 25 to 30 million young people, and not just young people, took to the streets with the protests against the assassination of George Floyd. 25 to 30 million people. Look at India for a minute. In 2019, before the pandemic, 250 million Indian workers went on a general strike. That's unbelievable. This is the biggest worker action in the history of the planet. So all over the world, we have these burgeoning social movements. We have this hunger for change and willingness to go out into the streets and struggle. But this takes place at a time when, just as you pointed out, the organized left, a socialist left, an anti-capitalist left, a radical left is weaker than ever. Simply doesn't exist. And third, when the organized working class, I'm not talking about workers taking action, because most people that go into the streets all around the world, they are part of the working class. But an organized worker, trade unions and organized working class organizations are also historically weak. So we have a triangular relationship here. We have an organized left, we have the organized working class, the unions and worker organizations, then we have the social movements. Two of those are historically weak. The other one is raring to go to bring about radical change and taking to the streets all over the world. So the way forward for us from below is really we have to resuscitate a democratic socialist left, and we have to build the worker organizations and have a three-way triangulation here, right? Those three points of this triangle. And we don't have that now. And I, of course, don't have the solutions. What I'm trying to do is offer the theoretical understanding of global capitalism, its crisis, and you know what's going on there within the system.
Do you have any suggestions? I know you're not the solution man, and I don't want to treat you as such. You are providing a sort of theoretical framework to work with. But do you think there's any ways that the masses can apply the needed pressure, especially to that third faction of elites that may be willing to sort of cut a deal and push reforms?
Right. Well, I mean, there's several things we can observe. One is that there's the younger generations, you certainly look younger than me, significantly younger. But so if you look at millennials, 51% of millennials say they prefer socialism over capitalism. And then the next generation after the millennials, the Generation Z, even more.
I was going to add real quick, I'm actually a millennial. And I always tell people, I feel like millennials and Zoomers, we don't really have any investments in the system. People always say, when you get older, you become more conservative. Well, that only works if you have investments already. I mean, most of my generation and Zoomers don't own homes or anything like that.
Exactly. Or it worked in the 20th century when there was prospects for upward mobility and stability and good jobs and so forth. So exactly. Your generation and the generation after you, the Z generation, faces extremely bleak prospects, no stake in the system, very little possibility as it's currently structured of simply even getting by. But here's the weakness of your generation, which, of course, I say respectfully, and you guys are the future, not me and my generation, is there's an aversion to theory. I'm giving some talks for some independent socialist organizations here, and some of the members say, you know, why in the hell do we need theory? We just take to the streets. We do need theory and analysis, because if you don't know your enemy and you don't know the nature of the system you're struggling against, you're not going to be very effective. So let's look, and I say this with total support, after, you know, when the anti-racist uprising had its peak in May and June. My wife and I, even though we're a vulnerable population for the virus, we couldn't resist. We went out for a couple of weeks straight here in Los Angeles. We saw the police repression, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of young people. So incredibly inspiring. But the entire analysis is simply that the police are racist and they should be defunded. Now, the police are racist and they should be defunded. But if you start and end your story there, you understand nothing. You need theory and analysis to take it to the next level. The police are simply the coercive arm of the capitalist state. The function of the police in the larger picture is to protect private property of the 1%, and beyond that, maybe 20%, and the wealthier neighborhoods and so forth. And that is the function of the police, to suppress any challenge to the system. So the police are simply an instrument of the larger system. And the analysis or theory that has accompanied this anti-racist uprising is simply not there. So if you're simply demanding defund the police because they're racist, stop racist police, the elites are going to take advantage of that to demobilize you, to diffuse the crisis they face when we all take to the streets. And that's exactly, I have a brilliant, quote here, if I can just grab it, exactly what has happened in the last few months with the anti-racist uprising. Here's an article I wrote on this. The powers that be are already embracing the language of struggle against quote unquote systemic racism. Racial justice is now being espoused by political and economic elites, CEOs of major global banks and corporations whose policies have perpetuated racial inequality have taken the knee, declared their quote unquote solidarity with aggrieved communities, as have Democratic and Republican Party stalwarts as they attempt to commodify and convert Black Lives Matter into a corporate logo. Lest the anti-racist struggle end up emptied of its transformative potential, it must identify and target capitalism as a system that gave rise to and continuously reproduces racism. So, you're asking me, the youth are the future in the front lines, ready to sacrifice so much, but we also need that theory and that analysis. And that would normally be the role of a well-organized democratic socialist left that we don't have. So we have this conundrum and of, I don't have the way forward. The way forward is going to be forged by, millions of people in struggle.
Before we close out, I just wanted to add one or two more things there and bounce it off you. With regards to this anti-racist struggle, I do think we need to do more than just say defund the police because they're racist, because you have to think about things like, okay, so we get rid of these racist cops and we start retraining the police, maybe. What do we do with the cops that we fired, though? Because they're very large in numbers and they're going to be angry and probably do militias and stuff like that. And I would say, right. Well, maybe you give them, go away pension type money, right? I mean, there are solutions to these things. But I like what you mentioned about the sort of capitalists trying to subsume this struggle now. We hear about these corporations having sensitivity training and things like this, but it's not really because they want to stop racism. It's because if someone does something racist at their job, they can say, well, we had this speaker, Robin DiAngelo, speak out against racism, so we're against that. And that's just that one person's fault. And, the corporation itself doesn't like racism. It's a way of covering their own butts, and they do things like this to sort of cover their own butts.
Exactly. Well, the conception of racism as simply individual attitudes, and you can teach people to have more positive attitudes towards racial diversity and so forth, is a conception which is not in the least bit threatening to the system. It doesn't do anything to really attack the structural roots of racism. The term structural racism gets bantered around, but most people, it's been co-opted, how we even understand structural racism, by the corporate and the political elite. If the underlying structures that produce racism are structures that come out of capitalism. I had in the same article I was mentioning to you some data there that, and if I remember correctly, the percentage of the population in the United States that's Black is 13%, and the percentage of Amazon workers that is Black is 42%. And so that is a structure of racism, in that the most dangerous jobs, the least remunerated jobs, the most vulnerable jobs are disproportionately come from workers, come from racially oppressed communities. So that is one of many examples of structural racism, how it's built into the system. You can tell every single Amazon worker, you can tell every single Amazon CEO, be sensitive to someone being Black or being Latino and not just, you know, not white, be sensitive to women. And, you know, in as if you're a man, and that will do nothing to change those structures. Absolutely nothing. And it will do nothing in the long run to stop police violence, because police violence is to shore up those structures. And, you know, I want to point out the other thing, that if corporations need the police to protect their profit, their domination, their wealth. The rich need the police. So if you want to get rid of the police or reduce the police influence, you have to reduce corporate power and you have to reduce inequality, so there's not so much rich and alongside so much poverty. So those are structural changes. And simply having sensitivity training, just as you said, is simply a mechanism for the ruling groups to deflect any real challenge to racism or to male domination or whatever we're targeting. Absolutely. That's how co-optation is central to this whole story. We didn't really talk about it that much, but how you neutralize any threat from below through co-opting rather than outright repression.
Is there anything you want to add in that regard? And then I promise to let you go. I know I kept you a few minutes over. Is there anything you want to add to that in regards to co-optation and neutralization that you think is really important for listeners to understand?
Only, and if I had more chance to think about my response, I'm sure I'd come up with a better response, but at the spur of the moment here, the extent to which we link our struggles for justice and social change to a theoretical and analytical understanding of what type of a social order we live in, what is this system that we're facing, what is the underlying, what underlies these conditions that we're struggling against. The extent to which we have a theoretical and analytical understanding is the extent that we are able to face up to this co-optation and resist the temptation to be co-opted. And so that involves, again, you know, we've been talking about the necessity of theory and of analysis, and I hope my book, The Global Police State, brings some of that to these mass struggles to the extent that is being read. And also there's one other thing we never got to talk about. Maybe I'll end with this, and that we need to bring class back into the story. So we can never lose sight of race and racism, its fundamental role that it has played 500 years in world capitalism. But when we divorce the struggle for racial equality and against racism, or divorce the struggle for gender or sexual equality from also from class and from the system, we are undermining the ability of those struggles to actually identify the deep structural origin of what they're fighting against. So we need to bring class back into the discussion and class analysis and join that with anti-racist and other forms of struggle.
So I want to thank you, William Robinson, for coming on Parallax Views. I felt like this was a very enlightening discussion. I feel that your books are very important. And I want you to let my listeners know how they can get a copy of The Global Police State.
Sure. Well, there's a well, of course, you can always go to Amazon, but that's not the best way because Amazon gets all the profits. But I mean, if you wanted to get it quick and easy, just go to Amazon and put The Global Police State in. But Pluto Books is my publisher. While they're based in London, they have the distribution center in Chicago. So you could just Google Pluto Books. And right now, between now and the US elections, they have a 50% off offer. So it normally costs $22. This costs $11. And they include an ebook. So if you get the hard copy for $11 with the 50% off, you also get a free ebook. So probably the best way between now and the elections to get the book is to go to just Google Pluto Press and go find their discount. They're called the U.S. the electoral discount, the elections discount.
I want to thank you again, William I. Robinson, for coming on Parallax Views. Thank you so much.
And thank you so much for having me on.
Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Professor William I. Robinson, author of the great new book, The Global Police State. Get a copy if you were interested in any of the topics we covered during the course of our conversation. I highly recommend it, folks. Highly recommend it. Professor Robinson's work is top-notch in caliber. As always, let me know what you thought about this edition of Parallax Views by dropping me a line on Twitter at @ViewsParallax or by email at
parallaxviewspod@protonmail.com. Producers credit shoutouts to Amelia, Mark, Martin, Brace, John, Ted, Zach, Gratz, and Mickey. If you'd like your very own producer's credit on each and every edition of Parallax Views, well, consider joining those aforementioned listeners and supporters of the show by pitching in $10 or $15 to the Parallax Views Patreon page at patreon.com/parallaxviews. That's patreon.com/parallaxviews. And with that being said,
until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views to Parallax Parallax Views with Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say don't do it, just to prohibit. It's nothing else. If we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, you know, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxiety problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight with no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.